when you look at all the police killings of Black people in the US, economists often respond by saying, we need to nudge cops to just act differently. We need to incentivize them. We need to nudge them rather than looking at race as this structural problem in society. So I think this has to do with the narrowing of economics and the depoliticizing of economics as well that has happened over the past half century, basically.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
One of the true joys of academia is the opportunity we have to interact with bright, young, energetic, and enthusiastic students. More than a decade ago, and while I was teaching a program in development studies, I was highly impressed with the analytical skills and motivation of one of the students in my class. She went on to study development studies at the London School of Economics and then did her PhD in economics at the New School. The student's name is Ingrid Harvold Kvangraven, and I'm delighted to have her as a guest on this podcast. Ingrid's research focuses on the role of finance in development, structural features of underdevelopment, the political economy of development, including the role of international institutions, and most importantly, she critically assesses the economics field. She's currently an assistant professor in international development at the University of York's Department of Politics. Ingrid is also the founder and editor of a highly influential blog called Developing Economics and founder and steering group member of Diversifying and Decolonizing Economics, or DECON, which is a network of economists that aims to promote inclusiveness in economics, both in terms of academic content and in its institutional structures. I began by asking Ingrid a very broad question. Why do some countries continue to be poor?
Thank you for this very big question. And this is the fundamental question that basically relates to why I chose to study development studies to begin with, which is when we met. And I think that I can't say I have the full answer, but in order to begin to answer this question, I would say that we need historical perspective and a political economy perspective. And dependency theory does provide parts of that. So in terms of history, I think we can't really say why some countries, you know, continue to be poor without looking back at, for example, colonial legacies, I think are key. The way countries, their economies were shaped, how their political systems were shaped to benefit the colonizers. So, for example, I'm currently doing some research in Senegal and Ghana right now with some colleagues. And we find that both the economic production structures, so what they produce and how they produce, and the financial structure, so the way banking works, the financial system works, is still marked by colonial legacies today, even, you know, 70 years after independence. So in terms of production, you see the economies are oriented to extract raw materials, basically for exports. And financial systems are, you know, the financial system is heavily dominated by foreign banks that aren't, that tend to not lend to domestic productive investments as much. So in that sense, I think history is really, really important. And then the second perspective is the political economy perspective. So whose economic and political interests are shaping the policies of donors and international institutions, but also domestic policies within developing countries. So these kinds of investigations lead us to look at, for example, the uneven rules of global trade or the policies promoted by international institutions or why certain institutions persist over time. So I'd say that these perspectives are key to begin to answer the question that you asked, a very big question. And I think dependency theory is definitely a fruitful way to address this. And this is what I started doing in my PhD. And I also recently published on this. And I think dependency theory, well, it has a bad reputation. It's been dismissed, I think, both in economics, but also in mainstream, but also in parts of heterodox economics. But I think it's often misunderstood. It's not really one theory. It's more of a research program, a way of approaching questions like the one you asked. So, and what's unique about it is that it takes this historical approach, political economy approach, and it, in addition, it also looks at how capitalism itself tends to be polarizing, and there's sort of different theories of why that's the case. And it also looks at specific constraints that developing countries face in terms of finance, for example.
Could you very briefly provide an overview of what is dependency theory or this dependency program approach that you have been working with? What are the essential features? What are the major arguments here?
Yeah, so basically the dependency theorists, so there's many of them, and they often disagree on some of the main reasons for dependence. But the main, the thing that unites them is that they see the economy of certain countries being conditioned by development processes elsewhere. So that could, for example, be about, a country like I mentioned, Ghana and Senegal, what they export or their production structures are shaped in a way because of both this history, but also because of the competition with the Global North and other countries in the Global South. So they're not really free to just kind of do what they want. They're dependent on the global economy. And being a part of the global economy leads to constraints in terms of both production and finance and a range of other things. So that's kind of a dependency in a nutshell. So I would also say that one other thing that's important to kind of keep in mind when thinking about dependency is that it's not like dependency theorists, well, most of them never said that development is impossible. They were more kind of outlining the reasons why it's really, really difficult uphill battle. So I would argue that, for example, South Korea, which is a successful case of development in many ways, that we can understand South Korea in many ways by using a dependency research program. So, for example, looking at how capitalism developed in a certain way in South Korea under Japanese colonialism that was different from how African countries, for example, experienced colonialism. And also that rather than just looking at the developmental state and the policies that they pursued, they also were able to get away from some of the constraints that dependency theorists would point to for geopolitical reasons. So they had a lot of financial support from the US, for example, and from Japan, which allowed them to have persistent deficits. They didn't run into like these financial constraints. And also they were able to implement a lot of like controls on trade and production that developing countries today aren't able to implement.
I want to probe this question a bit further. You said earlier that this kind of approach to understanding dependency theory has been easily dismissed. And the question really is, why? Why has this been dismissed? Is it because of uncomfortable questions of power imbalances? Is it a question of mainstream neoclassical economics being deliberately rigged to generate results that support the status quo? What explains this reluctance to approach these questions of poverty, of development, from this kind of a power perspective or much more of a political economy perspective?
The politicalness of the economics discipline and social science in general is a big part of the answer. When you see dependency theory discussed in sort of the mainstream of development economics today, you often see it dismissed for reasons like that it wasn't rigorous, that it's been disproved by, for example, the rise of South Korea. That's why I chose, the example of South Korea to to show that, you know, even South Korea, which is often used as a counterexample to dependency, doesn't really refute dependency theory. And it's often also misunderstood because with the word or the term dependency theory, it does sound like it's one theory. So a lot of its critics would say that, oh, you know, if you look at Raoul Prebisch, who is one, you know, dependency theorist, he writes something that's in contradiction with Samir Amin, who's another, and they clearly disagree. And therefore, the critics argue that dependency theory is confused, which is a misunderstanding because it's actually more of a collection of theories. And there was a lot of debate within dependency theory. So those are some of the reasons that are kind of put forward by critics of dependency theory. But I think it's impossible to really understand the squeezing out of dependency theory from economics in particular without looking at the discipline and how it's evolved over time, especially since the 70s. There's been this marginalization, not just of dependency theory, but of heterodox theories generally. So Keynesian theories, Marxian theories, structuralist, as economics has become increasingly focused on methods and on neoclassical economics, I would argue. So I would argue that that's the main reason dependency theory has been dismissed, because of this political development in the field.
So let's talk about methods then, because as you know, I'm a political scientist and I don't do quantitative studies. I know that a lot of my economist colleagues, and even in political science, even in sociology, there's been in certain countries like the United States, much more of an emphasis on quantitative studies. And there's this, you know, continued discussion, debates on which method is best, which method is most rigorous. Is it the large data sets versus the smaller in-depth case studies? How should we actually best approach development? And in this context, I've followed with great interest your own critique of the randomized controlled trial method, or the RCT, following particularly the kind of attention that was generated following the Nobel Prize in economics last year. And you wrote a piece in World Development that actually summed up some of your concerns. I wanted to ask you here, for the benefit of the listeners, what you think of the RCT method, which is, of course, considered by some to be the gold standard. Some say that that is the best way of coming up with unbiased and more consistent results. But others, like you, say that the main limitation to such experimental approaches is that perhaps they don't really address transformations, structural transformations, and the struggle for rights. So could you give us a sense of what you find most problematic with this RCT that is often considered to be the gold standard, even in economics?
Yes, of course. And so, I mean, especially since the Nobel Prize, so the Economics Nobel last year, there's been a lot of critiques that have been coming out. But even before then, it's a method that has been critiqued quite heavily, even though, or maybe because it's becoming the gold standard, as you mentioned. So I have three main critiques that I highlighted in the World Development article. And one is this focus that you kind of already mentioned, that I think, you know, it's concerned with technical approaches to poverty, not really development as structural transformation. And so while these small interventions that they look at, they might generate some positive results at the micro level, they do little to challenge these, you know, bigger systems that produce the problems in the first place. So just as an example, rather than looking at cuts to the education system or school system, for example, in a country that have been forced by austerity historically, the randomistas, as they're sometimes called, even among themselves, they direct our attention to, you know, why do teachers not come to work? Or what are the effects of school meals on student learning? Or how does the number of teachers in a classroom improve learning? So kind of very, very small questions within the, you know, bigger questions of how to run an education system in a country to begin with. So in that sense, they're very much removed from sort of analyses of power, wider social change. And this is why they got the Nobel Prize in the first place, or at least that's what the committee specifically said, that it was about addressing these smaller, more manageable questions. So that's in terms of focus. They're like thinking small. And then in terms of theory, I think it's also problematic because, and I mentioned before that economics is methods driven. This is not to say that, you know, that I'm against empirics or anything. Of course, empirical research is really, really important. But the problem is when the method becomes kind of abstracted from the theory or disconnected from the theory. At least they often argue that they're doing purely empirical work. And that's, I guess, nowhere more clear than when Esther Duflo said that economists are like plumbers. So this is like an analogy to show that this idea that economists come in and they fix problems. And her TED Talk is really good for any of the listeners who kind of want a big overview of how they think about development and social change generally. Esther Duflo talks about how, you know, we can't know anything about the big problems in development. Let's just fix and like answer the small questions that we can. But by doing so, they very often, well, they usually take the individual as a starting point, Homo economicus in particular, which is this concept in economics as this, you know, rational individual, behaves in certain ways, reacts to incentives, etc. So there's a close connection between the RCT works and behavioral economics, for example. And so I would say that it's quite dangerous to assert that economics is like plumbing, because what they're doing isn't purely technical. It is rooted in this particular theoretical framework and worldview, which sees, you know, the individual as the starting point and that sees individuals as rational. So that's the second critique, that it is still rooted in neoclassical theory, even though they claim to be purely empirical. And a third critique. So I think in terms of the method, even if they are, you know, super open about which theory they use and don't, you know, hide behind sort of technicalities, I still think that the method itself is quite limited. And that's because, you know, when you run a randomized control trial, you look at, you know, you have an intervention that you introduce to a group, you compare it to the control group, and then you see the difference in effect, and you kind of assume that the effect has to do with the intervention. But you don't actually know why that intervention led to that effect. It doesn't tell us anything about the mechanisms involved. And because of this, they don't really tell us whether a policy intervention can be reliably implemented in another context, because they don't know exactly what caused the effect to begin with. So in order to, you know, transfer that knowledge generated by the RCT, there needs to be a broader judgment, a broader assessment of the economic and social situation, the realities there, and the RCTs don't really give us that knowledge. So that's a sort of methodological issue.
But there are certain people, of course, lots of people would say asking the smaller questions is important. There's so much wastage in terms of us not knowing what is working, and in order to make development, in order to make aid more effective, we need to ask these questions, to have these methods that are well documented in the field of medicine, for example. And others would also say perhaps that, well, we can't really do everything. It's up to maybe others to find, you know, answers to these mechanisms that you were talking about. But we can at least identify and answer certain specific questions. What do you think of that? Are you dismissive of the whole RCT methods, or do you see some value in pursuing these strategies?
I think there are a few issues. And one is that, and I guess I'd like to correct my previous answer if I suggested that I think that the small questions aren't important, because I do think that they are important. And I'm not saying we shouldn't ask small questions. We should ask both. And as you said, right, it's, you know, not every researcher can ask, you know, all the big questions. So we need someone to ask the small questions as well. And I think Sara Stevano had a great article on this in the same issue in World Development, where she said, you know, we should ask small questions, but small questions require big answers. So this argument was about how even if we are interested in a specific problem that an individual has to deal with, the solution to that problem isn't necessarily limited to that individual. And Naila Kabir has also done some great work on this. I guess she could be classified as a microeconomist, but she looks at feminist economics and gender in general. And then again, it's the argument that it's not necessarily about the question itself, but it's about how to understand the solutions. And can RCTs really give us a good understanding of why a certain intervention worked? And I think a lot of feminist economists would argue that no, because especially if you're interested in issues of gender, it's very difficult to understand gender dynamics or issues that affect women in particular by only looking at the individual and assuming that they're behaving in a rational way or trying to nudge them to behave in a certain way and abstracting from the structural issues which don't necessarily have to do with, you know, it doesn't have to be imperialism. It could also be something like, you know, patriarchy. What are the structures that exist within a household or within a village that affect women's decisions that don't have to do with, you know, their own individual decision-making process? So that's an argument against whether RCTs are actually a helpful way to help us understand the small questions. In terms of medicine, I think it's an interesting analogy because economists really do rely on it quite a lot. And in the medicine literature, there's a lot more critiques of RCTs than in the economics, in the mainstream economics literature. And you often see in medical journals that doctors, medical professionals argue that RCTs can be helpful in certain settings, but it depends on the question being asked, basically. And I think this is a good approach. Depending on which question you're asking, you should choose the method rather than having the method determine what questions you ask. So in medicine, there are several examples of questions where it just doesn't work to study them through RCTs because each, for example, they try to use RCTs to look at how effective certain types of surgery were. But then every situation was different because there was a different surgeon, there were different issues with the patient. So they weren't able to randomize the study very reliably. So I think there are a lot of issues like that in economics as well, because it's, you know, social science. So there's a lot of messiness.
Let's move on to another set of broad issues, understandings of what development means. You know, this podcast is called In Pursuit of Development. And of late, I've been noticing, of course, well, not of late, of the last few decades, I suppose, that there is growing dissatisfaction, particularly among my students, among my colleagues on the African continent, in India, in China, in many parts of the world, against this Western understanding of development, of how poverty is defined, how politically correct or incorrect terms are used, how we measure social and political progress, what we assume to be the most important elements to development. I wanted to ask you what you consider to be the most interesting current debates in this field, and how economics or development economics is faring. Of course, I know that you are critical of mainstream economics, but I wanted to hear your views on how you see, understand development and what we can do to change that. Do you see the current discourse as being problematic, that it is too dependent on Western framing of the so-called problems?
Yeah, great question. And I think you're right that this has become more in the spotlight in the recent decade. And I do think that the way we use development and progress today tends to be in a quite Eurocentric way. But of course, it depends who. But generally, the mainstream narrative, you know, that you see in the media and in some circles of academia, it very often assumes this kind of linear narrative of progress, where this ultimate goal is this Western ideal of modernization, rationality, and that we're all trying to achieve development in the same way, that there's this universal notion of progress, which is problematic. And I do think that parts of the economics field build up under this, even if they're not explicitly arguing for a universal notion of progress. The RCTs, for example, that we just discussed, do assume this kind of technical development as this technical intervention of just improving technical fixes. So there's definitely a connection there. But I do think that in development studies, the debate is maybe a bit more advanced than in economics so far. And of course, there's lots of non-Western approaches that have been drowned out, but that are getting some traction more recently. So of course, there's a lot of them, but I find particularly helpful the post-independence activists that, you know, are very clear that development is this political economy question, and that the newly independent countries needed to kind of fight for development, that it was a struggle for autonomy against exploitation rather than this, you know, series of technical intervention. So I would say that, you know, how should we view development, or how would I view development? I think it's a political project, and there are different actors struggling to define it. So, you know, there are interesting understandings from lots of different corners. And, you know, a lot of non-Western scholars or traditions look at exploitation and imperialism. But there's, yeah, lots of different ways of thinking about development that that different groups will have depending on their political interests as well. So I think a helpful way to think about development is like as a contested term.
And that is something that I've been reading a lot about, that, and this is particularly in relation to, I suppose, somebody you know well, Sakiko Fukuda Parr, and my colleague Desmond McNeil, who've also written on this in relation to sustainable development, the SDGs, that there is currently this kind of an idea that everything is win-win. If only we do everything as is prescribed by major international global agreements or whatever, somehow development will take place. Whereas Fukuda Parr and McNeil and others argue that, well, that isn't as easy. It is always a matter of contestation. Which brings me to this idea of the 2030 Agenda and the Sustainable Development Goals. Ingrid, I know that you have worked with my friend and former colleague, or I don't know what I should say, but I like him a lot, Sanjay Reddy. And you've written a piece with him, and this was several years ago when the SDGs were still new. I wanted to ask you what you think about the SDGs now. We're talking about a very ambitious global project that is unlike anything we've had before. A lot of countries, a lot of organizations have been involved. It's been highly participatory. We have the full range of developmental problems addressed in addition to environment and climate change. Big businesses and small businesses are also excited. I've never seen the private sector as interested in development as they are now. I see growing enthusiasm, not very much among the political elite, but there is growing enthusiasm. And yet I feel deflated sometimes when I look at some of these UN reports and take part in these discussions, where I feel that people really don't understand that this is about politics, that the politics of development is somehow marginalized in these current international discourses on the SDGs. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, I know that you are sympathetic, I suppose, to the SDGs to a certain extent, but you also share some concerns. Am I right?
Yeah, and definitely. I think you put it well, the politics are marginalized. And I think, yeah, when you see so many actors, including the private sector and political elites, really enthusiastic about something, you know, then it's worth scrutinizing, because I do think that the win-win, I mean, there are some things that are win-win, But of course, there's a lot of political struggles as well that are papered over in the SDGs, I think. And of course, I mean, I do think that they are an improvement on what we had before with the Millennium Development Goals. They are, you know, more global, more structural. They're more participatory, as you mentioned. They came about in a more participatory way. But this, the idea of global development in general, papers over a lot of the political contestations in development. This idea that development can happen, you know, in Norway and in the UK in the same way that it can happen in Malawi, hides a lot of the differences between countries. And we see this, I mean, the SDGs in a way, and I think we mentioned it a little bit in the paper with Sanjay, about SDGs as a language game. But I've been thinking about it even more recently, that in a way, I don't know if we're really changing what we're doing because of the SDGs, or if we're just framing everything that we're already doing in terms of the SDGs. Because now, well, before the SDGs, it was more international development that people talked about. Now we talk about global development. The private sector, I don't know if they're doing more or anything differently, or if they're just framing what they're doing in terms of the SDGs. In terms of academics, I know that a lot of the time I have to try to frame what I'm doing in terms of the SDGs in order to get funding, for example. And it's not necessarily changing what people do, at least from what I've seen in the private sector and in academia, but rather just sort of discursive change. And I think, well, that's, in a way, I see that as a kind of a best case scenario in a way. Because the worst case would be that we do change what we do and kind of hide the political battles in development by, you know, promoting these win-win-win solutions, as you were mentioning. And I think, for example, there are lots of ambitious goals in the SDGs, but in terms of where the developed countries especially might lose, those sort of targets and goals that have to do with the commitments by the Global North are much weaker. So, for example, I mean, there's lots of examples if you look at the SDGs, but like the means of implementation, for example, tend to be very weak and broad and not very specific compared to the goals themselves. So, for example, yeah, the goal one is to end poverty in all its forms everywhere, which I think is really, really radical and would be, you know, amazing if we could achieve that by 2030. But then the means of implementation is to ensure significant mobilization of resources from a variety of sources, which doesn't actually, you know, hold anyone to account. It's very vague.
You're touching upon a lot of the criticisms that I also subscribe to. You see, the problem, Ingrid, is that when I discuss these issues, I suppose when I mention this to practitioners or some policymakers would say, you know, you academics are just interested in criticizing and coming up with all of this contestation. We really need to agree now that we actually have agreement on this set of issues. Let's just move forward, you know, let's not look behind. So there's this idea often promoted that we're starting a new agenda on a clean slate. We don't really need to continue discussing all the problems and challenges. So that's one set of issues. People say, you know, we need solutions, not more discussion on the problems. The second aspect, as you rightly point out, is also this inconsistency, I suppose you can call it, between certain proclamations and very radical sounding goals and then very minimalistic ways of measuring, so that you have the indicators that don't necessarily measure what the goal is supposed to be. And that could be, say, on inequality or anything really. Sometimes there isn't enough data. So there are all of those challenges. But my major criticism of late has been that it's those messy local political issues, who gets what, in what sequence should we do development? What happens when you don't have the money for everything? Those things are somewhat obscured and neglected. People don't want to talk about the uncomfortable questions. Another issue I feel that concerns me is that when one talks about the SDGs, it is as if, we are all in the same boat and there are no sort of national interests and everybody agrees that there's this one way. And if only we all saw the different colors of the rainbow, we'll get there. I don't think it is going to be that easy. There is no discussion about trade-offs. The SDGs are fantastic in saying, oh, everybody should get things like the universality principle. Nobody should be left behind. So we should be, looking after these marginalized groups. And then we should also be promoting integration of development and environment. But that is not happening. So, I'm going on a little rant here, but I feel that there's a lot of rhetoric, but very little operationalization. So sometimes I feel the SDGs are great for international conferences where we all agree to do something, but we never really get down to doing it.
Yeah, that's also how I feel when I talk about the SDGs. I start wanting to go on a rant. And I agree with everything that you're saying, of course, I understand people that say we need solutions and not problems and not problematize everything. But I think you touched on an important part that was, we have all these great goals. How do we get there? Of course, we have to debate that and discuss it because there isn't like one way that we can achieve the SDGs. It'll depend on the context. And in many ways, the indicators, and you touched on it as well, are very depoliticizing. So, if we try to just, look at the indicators we could do really well on the indicators and still not achieve the goals, basically, because of this mismatch. So one aspect that I think is really important to really discuss and problematize that isn't really enshrined in the SDGs, but it kind of came with the SDGs, is this whole idea of how do we finance them? And there's a big debate now, and especially, well, it started before the SDGs, but especially now with the SDGs, of pushing for market-based finance, that the SDGs, will somehow finance themselves if we just build these resilient financial markets in developing countries. So this is what Daniela Gabor called the Wall Street consensus, basically. She argues that it's the global investors who want this, looking for investment opportunities outside of the global north, where interest rates are really low. So this is where I think it's a crucial moment to problematize this and to look at what kind of, financial institutions do lead to development locally and sort of external, what kind of external finance do we need to finance the SDGs? And I really, I find the idea that there can be a win-win there a little bit problematic.
I don't mind that the private sector is showing increased interest. I think that's great. And I'm sure one could have very productive public-private partnerships. But I see that the private sector often is not equipped to understand local contexts in some of these low-income country settings. They don't really know much how the public sector works there, how the private sector works there, what are the incentives. What are the governance challenges? And so they are very unwilling to take that risk. And when there is talk about risk, there is often the need, at least from the private sector's perspective, of governments and international organizations like the World Bank providing some sort of a cushioning so that the risk is eliminated. So I think, in terms of financing, I'm sure in some parts of the world, the businesses that are showing interest will be able to make a difference, but they can't just cherry pick whichever goal. Let's say if they're working on fisheries or something, it'll be somehow promoted as being promoting SDG 2 on hunger. And similarly, those working on, in environmentally polluting industries can do certain small changes and market themselves or greenwash themselves and say they're promoting some SDG. So there's always that risk. But I still feel that we really need to somehow perhaps have a new discussion. I don't think there is so-called the end of development with the SDGs. I think there are still lots of debates out there. And when I talk to policymakers, they say, well, you know, the 2030 agenda is just a small part, really. We have so many other foreign policy objectives. We use all kinds of other criteria in our interactions with other developing countries or low-income countries. There's China, there's India. So in many ways, I feel that the 2030 agenda is not really perhaps the definitive development agenda, as some would like to believe, that there are so many other things out there. And when I talk to local policymakers in Africa, in Asia, et cetera, they say, oh, but, you know, we were barely finished with the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals. Now we have the SDGs. We can't keep up. We're still working in silos. So there are all of those challenges. I wanted to get back to this issue, Ingrid, about multilateral agencies and organizations like the World Bank, like the IMF, UN agencies. One of my earlier guests on this podcast, Degan Ali, who is a civil society representative, she was highly critical of the United Nations system. She felt that the whole global governance architecture on development is flawed. Unfortunately, there's nothing better, she says, but the UN really requires radical reforms. But those kinds of reforms haven't really taken place. What is your take on the global governance architecture for development?
Yeah, great, great question. But before I answer that, I just wanted to say that I agree about the private sector. And I don't think that there's anything wrong. It's not that anyone in the private sector is doing anything wrong. It's just that, of course, or I think that it would make businessmen or women don't necessarily, they're not acting in the interest of a specific, you know, changing the domestic structures of a country. They're acting to promote their own business, of course, which makes sense. But then I think, so the issue with the SDGs then becomes to see where can the private sector play a positive role, and where actually do we need something else or something more? Like, for example, with health systems, is somewhere, especially with COVID, we've seen that the countries with, you know, defunded, more privatized health systems did worse than countries with more better funded public health systems. And in a way, you know, we need more. It's not like the private sector is pouring lots of money into developing countries, because there aren't that many investment opportunities in the big sense. So it's a complicated dynamic, of course. But then, yeah, so back to your question on the UN system and the multilateral system and how it works or doesn't work for development. And I would agree with your previous guest that, I mean, there's lots of problems with the UN, of course, because it's a big, you know, international institution. But I do think that I agree that it's the best that we have, and it's better than other global institutions that aren't, at least, you know, the developing countries have more of a vote in the UN, or they have more of a say than in some of the big international financial institutions where they have very, very little say. So I think, you know, the UN system should be strengthened, but in recent years it's been weakened, right? So which gives even more reason for critique of the system, which probably then leads to this negative feedback loop of it being even weakened even more. But I would agree that it's something that we should strive to strengthen and improve, make it more democratic, and continue having these debates.
It has become quite fashionable to bash the UN. And one set of arguments in support of the UN is that the UN is only as powerful as the member countries want it to be. And we see in some parts of the world, particularly in the United States, there's far less enthusiasm for the UN. There's always been a lack of enthusiasm, but perhaps it's been strengthened in the last 4 years. There's a lack of interest in funding UN agencies. The WHO, of course, has recently been in the news, how the US has withdrawn its commitment. So financing is one set of issues, but I suppose another way of criticizing current policies to say that the UN perhaps is out of touch with reality. At least that's what some of the critics would say, that it has become very technocratic, that it is not in a position to perhaps take a bold stand when a bold stand is needed, you know, matters of politics. It's this playing safe. The neutrality principle does not appear well suited to tackle some of the problems of modern day life. What do you think?
That's the problem with the UN. But that's how it's become, right? And we don't necessarily want the UN to take this, you know, bold step in terms of development, because development is something that's contested, right? So it's exactly what you said. It's basically it can't be any better than the member countries that it represents. And there's vast disagreements among the member countries, of course. But then, I mean, back to the point you made earlier about the role of the UN, like for actual policymakers in the global south, is, you know, probably a bit overplayed a lot of the time in the global north, because there are so many different interests that domestic policymakers take into account, including, of course, the interests of their populations. So the SDGs are important for sort of the global development discourse, but they might not be that important for how things actually happen on the ground, luckily, I think.
So, Ingrid, what are your thoughts on the World Bank's approach to poverty reduction? Your thesis advisor, Sanjay Reddy, has been very critical about measurements on world poverty and how flawed they are. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, the way in which we measure progress, the way in which we perhaps are being told the narrative that is being constructed, that there has been some reduction, and even though it is mainly China and some other countries like India, we are on track, we need more money, COVID is perhaps pushing us, has just eroded some of the progress that we achieved, but we are on the right track. So in terms of poverty, in terms of mainstream economic understandings of the poverty line, what are your thoughts on that? Do you agree with the measurements, the PPP methodology? Do you see more participatory, better methods, more dynamic methods of measuring world poverty?
So I think, of course, the World Bank narrative on poverty also feeds into the enthusiasm around the SDGs, because it was used to argue that the MDGs were a success. And like the MDGs were a success because poverty was halved. So that's kind of a false argument in a way, because it's not like the MDGs led to halving of poverty. If we look at why poverty was reduced by the measure that they used, it was largely because of China. So that's one thing. And then, and of course, it would be difficult to argue that China, that poverty reduction in China was because of the MDGs. That would be a bit of a leap. But that's just taking the measure at face value. But then the measure itself, of course, is problematic. One, because it's a bit random. Like, why look at $1 a day or $2 a day and not, you know, something that's meaningful for the context in which people find themselves? Sanjay and his co-authors did this study where they looked at this institution that decides how to or who to give food stamps to, and like how much is needed to just for food in New York. And they found that that would be about four PPP dollars a day in New York just for food, and then plus housing, of course, clothes. So the poverty line is already very, very low. It's one thing, it's too low. And then the second thing is that it's not based on a kind of material assessment of what people actually need to live a life free of poverty or with their basic needs met.
Ingrid, there's been a lot of discussion of late on economics as a discipline and some of the major issues of our times that economics has not perhaps addressed to the full extent or is perhaps incapable of understanding. And two issues, of course, two topics that have come up for criticism has to do with race and inequality. And you've written about this too. And my question is, do economists have trouble understanding race and inequality and racialized inequalities?
Yeah, I think they do. So yeah, I guess the piece I wrote was, why do they have trouble? Because the finding that I was showing was that they have trouble in the sense that it doesn't feature in economics education. Economists don't teach about racial inequality or colonial legacies. And I think this comes back to what I mentioned earlier about how they see the individual as separate from society, this kind of homo economicus, what economists call methodological individualism, where it's very difficult to see a structure. So the way that they approach inequality or especially racialized inequalities is often then by looking at the faults with the individual itself. So for example, oh, people of a certain identity don't achieve these outcomes because they are just not good enough, or they don't have good enough education, they're not working hard enough, would be one way. And then sort of a bit more sophisticated way would be to say, oh, okay, well, people have a preference for discrimination. So an employer might not hire people from certain identities because they don't like them. So there's this kind of, it still comes from a kind of individual preference rather than looking at the structure itself. And this has also led to, like now, especially relevant with the Black Lives Matter movement, that when you look at all the police killings of Black people in the US, economists often respond by saying, ah, okay, we need to nudge cops to just act differently. We need to incentivize them, we need to nudge them, rather than looking at race as this structural problem in society. So I think this has to do with the narrowing of economics and the depoliticizing of economics as well that has happened over the past half century, basically. And what was worrying because the findings that I wrote about in that article were based on a survey of how economists teach economics, both heterodox and mainstream. And what worried me was that the findings also showed that younger mainstream economists or more junior mainstream economists tend to pay much less attention to race and structural inequalities and colonialism than more senior economists. So it's not even like the discipline is moving in the right direction, which is concerning.
I suppose it is a big challenge for, as you mentioned, the young economists or young scholars who want to publish, who want a career, and find it perhaps quite challenging to oppose ideas and policies and practices that are well established. I wanted to know how you see yourself as, are you an economist? Do you feel that you're an economist? And how is your role as a heterodox economist viewed by others?
That's a good question. So I think I'm an economist. Other economists might not see me as one, but I'm heterodox economist, and I've started claiming that title more and more, or that label more and more recently. I think, you know, when I started studying development studies at the interdisciplinary BA that you were part of, or that you led, I took courses in different disciplines, including economics and human geography, anthropology, sociology, political science, and whatever there was. And I felt like I didn't really economics didn't give me what I was looking for then. I wanted to understand global inequality, and I was interested in, you know, why did structural adjustment fail, for example, you know, these big kind of political questions. And I found in economics, it was more about like just doing the math. I didn't find it interesting. But then later when I studied at LSE and took one mainstream economics course and then a course with Robert Wade, he made it very clear that there was this divide between heterodox economics and the mainstream that I found really, really interesting, and which is why I went on to do my PhD at a heterodox economics institution. And so now, as someone who's trained in heterodox economics, I kind of increasingly see my role as like needing to raise awareness about it. Also, to, you know, to all those students who were like me, who just didn't really realize that, you know, there is a different kind of economics out there, that you don't have to become a sociologist, you know, if you're interested in structural inequalities, for example. You can be an economist, but you just have to, you know, choose your PhD institution wisely, I guess. And also to make students aware, to make the public aware, and also just to show everyone in the world that this is it's a very political discipline, that there's, just like development is contested, the way we study economics is contested. So I've taken on that role more and more since my PhD. And now I have like a research agenda also trying to define heterodox economics and push for it to become a positive term.
It was just such a pleasure to see you here online and to talk to you. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the news among your friends and share it on social media. The Twitter handle for this podcast is GlobalDevPod.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Banik from the University of Oslo Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.